You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heise's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 57, Acts 22. I'm your layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Very good. Glad to be back for another week, another episode.
All right. Well, we're almost done with Acts, so I guess Acts 22 this week.
Yep. We're trucking our way through it. So one chapter today. We've been doing two, but we'll focus on one today and sort of see what happens after that.
Sounds good.
All right. So let's go to Acts 22. Now, for those who either know, or I should say those who don't know, or who didn't happen to listen last week, Acts 21 ends with Paul, again, causing a riot. He's in the temple at Jerusalem. The Jews from Asia, again, who had troubled him earlier in his travels, show up, at least some of them, and they spot him. They start a riot. He gets arrested. He has to be, you know, saved from the mob by Roman guards. And at the end of Acts 21, we read this. As Paul was about to be brought into the barracks, he said to the tribune, again, the Roman tribune, "May I say something to you?" And he said, Do you know Greek? Are you not the Egyptian then who recently stirred up a revolt and led the 4,000 men of the assassins out into the wilderness?" So the Roman guy thinks he's some other criminal. Paul replied, "I'm a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no obscure city. I beg you, permit me to speak to the people." And when he had given him permission, Paul, standing on the steps, motioned with his hand to the people, and then there was a great hush, and he addressed them in the Hebrew language, saying, and that's where Acts 22 begins. So let's just jump into 22. I mean, what we're going to encounter here is really going to pick up on something that we had discussed earlier, way back in episode 50, so seven episodes ago, when we were talking about Acts 14. So I'm going to start just a couple verses into this, and then I'm going to go back to Acts 14 and sort of pick up again with why we connected Acts 14 to Acts 22 and get everybody caught up to speed. So Paul starts to speak here in Acts 22. He says, "Brothers and fathers, hear the defense that I now make before you." And when they heard that he was addressing them in the Hebrew language, they became even more quiet. And he said, "I'm a Jew, born in Tarsus in Cilicia and brought up in this city, educated at the feet of Gamaliel, according to the strict manner of the law of our fathers, being zealous for God, as all of you are this day. I persecuted this way to the death, binding and delivering to prison both men and women, as the high priest and the whole council of elders can bear me witness. From them I received letters to the brothers, and I journeyed toward Damascus to make those also, or to take those also who were there, and bring them in bonds to Jerusalem to be punished." And from this point on, Paul is going to get into his testimony, which, again, we've covered in previous episodes about how he went to Damascus, and he gets knocked off the horse, and the light shines down on him, and he hears the voice of Jesus, "I'm Jesus of Nazareth, whom you're persecuting," so on and so forth. We know Paul's conversion story. And, you know, after Paul's conversion, it becomes a little murkier, because the part of his life that we're familiar with is just what he's going to get into. And he really, from this verse that we stopped at, right around verse 6, all the way to 16, we get the familiar story of Paul, his testimony. Again, what happens to him on the way to Damascus, how Ananias, again, befriended him, how he was baptized and the scales fell from his eyes, and so on and so forth. We all know that. Again, that's the part about Paul's life that we know. We don't really know that well what happened to him afterwards, sort of what he did prior to when he shows up in the book of Acts, in Acts 13, and then at the Jerusalem Council, you know, reporting about his ministry and so on and so forth. It's Acts 13 that really marks when Paul begins to engage in sort of endorsed ministry, or the, you know, the ministry that God had really picked out for him. So there's this sort of nebulous period, and that's going to become an issue when we return to Acts 22. Now, let's go back to Acts 14. Back in episode 50, we were following Paul and his companions through their missionary journeys. And in Acts 14, we hit this specific episode. Let me read. This is Acts 14, 19 through 23. "Jews came from Antioch and Iconium, and having persuaded the crowds, they stoned Paul and dragged him out of the city, supposing that he was dead. But when the disciples gathered about him, he rose up and entered the city. And on the next day, he went on with Barnabas to Derbe, and so on and so forth. When they had preached the gospel to that city, they had made many disciples. They returned to Lystra. Lystra is where he got stoned. And to Iconium and Antioch, strengthening the souls of the disciples. So we asked the question when we were at this point earlier, is this event, when he was stoned at Lystra, what Paul is referring to or referred to later when he wrote his second letter to the Corinthians in 2 Corinthians 12, where Paul describes sort of a mystical, you know, spiritual experience. So we asked the question, did Paul have an NDE, a near-death experience at Lystra? And there have been others who have asked that question. If you recall from episode 50, our answer was no. Because really, because of the chronology. Let me read 2 Corinthians 12, though, so that you sort of know what I'm talking about. So we have Paul there in Lystra. He gets stoned. You know, did he have an NDE? Is this what he's referring to when he writes this chapter or these verses as follows? So here's 2 Corinthians 12. It's going to be verses 1 through 10. Paul says, "I must go on boasting, though there is nothing to be gained by it. I will go on to visions and revelations of the Lord. I know a man in Christ who 14 years ago was caught up to the third heaven, whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know. God knows. And I know that this man was caught up into paradise, whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know. God knows. And he heard things that cannot be told, which man may not utter. On behalf of this man, I will boast, but not on my own, but on my own behalf, I will not boast except of my weaknesses. Though if I should wish to boast, I would not be a fool, for I would be speaking the truth. But I refrain from it, so that no one may think more of me than he sees in me or hears from me. So to keep me from becoming conceited because of the surpassing greatness of the revelations." So that statement right there connects what he has just been describing, this sort of anonymous person, this man in Christ, you know, who saw visions and revelations of the Lord. Here he says, so to keep me from becoming conceited because of the surpassing greatness of the revelations. He connects himself to this person. He is this person. He says, to keep me from becoming conceited, a thorn was given me in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to harass me, to keep me from becoming conceited. Three times I pleaded with the Lord about this, that it should leave me. But he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you. My power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly of my weaknesses, so that the power of Christ may rest upon me. For the sake of Christ, then, I am content with weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and calamities. For when I am weak, then I am strong. Now, that's the first 10 verses of 2 Corinthians 12. So scholars have wondered, you know, what is he talking about? You know, this visions and revelations of the Lord. And some asked, well, you know, maybe, you know, what happened at Lystra, maybe there's a connection here. Well, the problem with it, as I mentioned in passing before, and also back in episode 50, was this chronological reference point 14 years ago. If you go through the chronology of the life of the Apostle Paul, the Lystra event is really hard to align with Paul's comment in 2 Corinthians 12, 2 about something that happened to him 14 years ago. And so for that reason, and for some other things that we'll get into today, it seems best to identify what Paul writes about in 2 Corinthians 12 was some other event in his life. And that event is something he refers to in Acts 22. So let's go back to Acts 22. Again, Paul is giving his testimony right in verses 6 through 16. So I want to jump back in at verse 17. Now listen to what Paul says. Okay, he's just given his testimony. You know, he's been baptized now. And verse 17 of Acts 22 says this, "When I had returned to Jerusalem and was praying in the temple, I fell into a trance and saw him saying to me, 'Make haste and get out of Jerusalem quickly, because they will not accept your testimony about me.' And I said, 'Lord, they themselves know that in one synagogue after another I imprisoned and beat those who believed in you. And when the blood of Stephen, your witness, was being shed, I myself was standing by and approving and watching over the garments of those who killed him. And he, the Lord, said to me, "Go, for I will send you far away to the Gentiles." In verse 22, up until this word, the crowd listened. They listened to Paul. Then they raised their voices and said, "Away with such a fellow from the earth, for he should not be allowed to live." Of course, then the Roman tribune takes him to the barracks, and then the rest of the story ensues. But what I want to focus on in this episode, the rest of this episode, is this little anecdote by Paul We know the story of his conversion. He goes to Damascus. Ananias befriends him. He gets baptized. The scales fall from his eyes, and eventually they have to help him escape Damascus. Okay, so right around when that's happening, I don't really like the ESV translation. When I had returned to Jerusalem, and he gets this, he falls into a trance, and the voice says, "Make haste and get out of Jerusalem, you know, quickly." I mean, I don't think there's really a chronological problem with that. I guess I can live with the rendering, but some might think that there's a little confusion there. I mean, just look at what it says. He goes back to Jerusalem, was praying in the temple, falls in a trance, and a voice says, "Well, you know, yeah, you're back here in Jerusalem, but now get out of here. You know, get out of Jerusalem quickly, because they won't accept your testimony about me." Again, you could fiddle with the language there a little bit to make maybe the transition, the itinerary a little bit clearer, but I guess it's adequate. The point is that Paul leaves Damascus, goes back to Jerusalem, and at some point, we're not really told how long he's there, even in other places he alludes to, you know, what he's doing. At some point, Jesus appears to him. Okay, he's in a trance. "I fell into a trance and saw him," saying to me. Well, the "him" in context there is the Lord. And we know at the, you know, he addresses him as the Lord. Then around in verse 21, he said to me, "Go, for I will send you far away to the Gentiles." We know it's the Lord. But so at some point while he's there in Jerusalem, the Lord comes to him and says, "Get out of here. You know, I know you had to leave Damascus. You came here. Well, that's logical. But you got to get out of here too, because it's just not the time for you to be here. They're not going to accept what you say. You need to go somewhere else." And he does. And again, Paul alludes to some other things that he did before Acts 13, when he winds up back, or at 13 through 15, he winds up, you know, back in Jerusalem, telling the disciples, the church of Jerusalem, what's going on. Then they do accept him. So there's this interval there, but it's initiated by this trance, which is really kind of odd. It's very easy, you know, to miss this line about him praying in the temple, and then he falls into a trance. A lot of scholars think this is the event that Paul is referring to in 2 Corinthians 12. In other words, when he falls into this trance early in his life as a believer, shortly after his conversion, when this happens to him, this is what he sees, what he describes in 2 Corinthians 12. And we don't get a whole lot of details. You know, he says, "I was caught up, you know, this man, was caught up into paradise." Whether it's in the body or out of the body, I don't know. Only God knows. Okay, so we get that little detail. He hears things that really he shouldn't have heard, and that he shouldn't talk about, or he doesn't want to talk about. And after that, you know, this quote-unquote messenger of Satan, you know, harassed him, the thorn in his flesh, and he asks God to deal with that, to take it away. And of course, God says, "My grace is sufficient for you," so on and so forth. So we get these little snippets that have something to do with this experience that he alludes to in Acts 22:17, or at least Luke does, and then, of course, that Paul, if there's a connection, alludes to in 2 Corinthians 12. So I'm going to go on with that presumption that there is a connection between this trance event in Acts 22 and what Paul is writing in 2 Corinthians 12. What I'm going to do is lay out why scholars think that this is a good candidate. The first reason is that it does work with the chronology. Okay, because this would have been very early in Paul's life as a believer, shortly after his conversion. So there's no chronological obstacle to it. But the real reason why scholars feel sort of compelled to consider this is because what Paul describes in 2 Corinthians 12 has some really interesting parallels to Jewish literature, Jewish, you know, theological literature about visionary experiences, and also literature that was well before this era. So what Paul is describing here has parallels in contemporary literature to his own lifetime, and also to literature that would have been, you know, a few hundred years earlier, stuff that we found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So scholars have noticed this, and I want to take you through some of these elements just so that you can sort of understand why scholars think about these references and these passages the way they do. Now, as far as a background, there are, you know, some sort of genres or subgenres of literature that are a lot like this. I'll mention two specifically. One is called, and you might run into this if you're doing Bible study and you're doing background study, one is called hechalot literature. Hechalot is the Hebrew term, it's a plural, for palaces or temples. Okay, so hechalot literature describes sort of cosmic journeys through concentric levels of heavenly palaces or heavenly temples. Okay, that's one type. The other type is known as Merkava mysticism. And Merkava can either be spelled with a B, Merkaba, or Merkava with a V. It's pronounced V if you're saying it in Hebrew, Merkava, mysticism. The word literally means throne chariot. Okay, a Merkava is a throne chariot. It's the thing in Ezekiel 1. It's this throne upon which God was seated in Ezekiel 1 that has cherubim underneath it, and the cherubim have wings and it moves around and that sort of thing. There's a whole body of literature, especially between the Testaments, especially, even more so among the Dead Sea Scrolls, that have, again, these mystical heavenly visions of the throne chariot of God, and even some in the Songs of the Sabbath Sacrifice, that's a specific Dead Sea Scroll, that have multiple chariot thrones flying around the throne room of God. Again, that text specifically is an interesting divine council text because it shows divine plurality and associating multiple thrones with God's thrones sort of takes us mentally back to Daniel 7 when the thrones, plural, were set in that divine council meeting. And then, of course, the verdict is given about the destruction of the fourth beast and whatnot. And you have the Son of Man appearance there. So the Merkava mysticism, and specifically that text with multiple chariot thrones, harkens back again to a divine council meeting. So these are the two major bodies of literature that literate Jews would have known prior to Paul and also listening to Paul and reading 2 Corinthians 12. They would have seen some things that were familiar to them. Now, why is that important? Well, it's important because they considered these things credible. They considered these things credible testimony. They had people in their own tradition, their own Jewish tradition. Okay, let's just set this weird thing called Christianity aside. There were very influential and important figures in Judaim that claimed to have had these experiences, and they were embraced as reality. They're not lying. This is true. This is true testimony. And they knew, again, from the Old Testament, if you've read part of my Myth That Is True draft, this whole motif of the way you legitimize, the way you can tell whether a prophet or a prophetic figure is legitimate is he has a divine encounter. That is the litmus test for legitimacy in biblical theology, for to be a spokesperson for God. Well, Jews were well aware of that. And again, some of those divine encounters were these, throne room visions. And so when people in their own religious tradition that they respected highly, important rabbis, for example, sort of couched their own authority in the same kinds of visions or very similar visions, they took them seriously. Well, here's Paul. Here's Paul saying, relating his testimony and saying the same thing. And you can see for them to be consistent, they better essentially shut up and listen. And it's really inconsistent for them to reject Paul's testimony while they're accepting somebody else's. So it is important for that reason in terms of putting Paul in context and what he's saying. But there's a real specific one of these accounts that I want to sort of focus on that becomes really, it has some really striking points of analogy to what Paul says in 2 Corinthians 12. And I want to focus on that just a little bit. To set that up, you have to realize that these mystical texts in Judaism, they were actually forbidden reading to lay people. There's something that this is a scholarly term, but there's something scholars talk about called the Merkava restriction. And this is the rabbinic prohibition against people who were not officially sanctioned rabbis or scribes and scholars were not supposed to read this material because the supposition is you're not going to be able to understand it. You're going to parse it incorrectly. You're going to mess up the theology of them. And the reason is, catch this. This will be very familiar again for those who are familiar with the work I do. The reason they didn't like it was because some of these visions, just like Daniel 7, have God in anthropomorphic form and visible. In other words, God appears as a man visible. And they also have divine plurality. So the rabbis wanted people to not look at passages that had the second power. Okay, the anthropomorphized Yahweh of the Old Testament, the second Yahweh figure, the one that was visible in human form. He said, well, we don't want you to look at that because that's just, you're not going to be able to handle that. You're not going to be able to really understand that. Let a professional rabbi tell you what that means. So there was actually an official rabbinic restriction against reading this material. And you run across it, in the Talmud and all these other, Jewish sources about, that this is off limits. And of course we, can just go read this stuff. But there was actually a restriction, I'll just read you one of them, might as well. The Mishnah states that no individual was permitted to, quote, expound HaMerkavah, okay, unless he was a Chacham. You know, HaMerkavah is the throne chariot. So no individual is permitted to expound throne chariot material unless he is a Chacham, a wise man, a sage. Okay, in the pre-rabbinic era, Chacham would have sort of referred to as, again, any sort of mystic. But in the rabbinic period, it's a term that was used specifically for sanctioned, officially recognized rabbis. Again, if you weren't one of those, you shouldn't be reading this. And I find it really interesting, again, because here it's one of these hints that the Jews understood that Yahweh does show up in our Bible as a man. And they, of course, knew that in some instances, both figures, the anthropomorphic Yahweh and then the invisible Yahweh, are in the same scene. Again, this is going back to the stuff that I do on the two powers in heaven idea. That was officially accepted as Jewish theology up until the second century, which not coincidentally coincides with the rise of Christianity. Okay, the idea of a Godhead was okay in Judaism until Christianity came along. And so this prohibition takes us right back into that turf so that the Jews know that, boy, you know, we can't just let anybody know this because their minds might drift over to this Christian stuff. And eventually they just declared it a heresy. But here, you know, again, when we're talking about Paul's day, this was just something you didn't do unless you were, you know, an official scholar, an official rabbi. Now, one of these, again, particular incidences, some of you may have heard of this one because it comes up a lot. I've actually heard this on shows like Coast to Coast AM and some other talk shows because it's sort of a well-known Jewish legend, but it's called the Pardes legend. Now, Pardes, you could probably tell, sounds a lot like paradise. Okay, we get our word paradise from this term. And the Pardes legend is the story of four men who went into paradise. That's how we would anglicize it to make an English word. And it's found in the Tosefta and in both Talmuds as part of a collection that is further part of the Mishnah. So Pardes, again, is a Hebrew term. Literally, it refers to an orchard or a garden. Well, Eden. Okay, that's not a hard association to make. Again, Eden, of course, was the place where God dwelled, which was paradise. Okay, so you can see how, you know, mentally we get there. So the story goes that these four men are allowed to enter Pardes, paradise. And the four are Ben Azai, Ben Zoma, a man named Acher, which is a name for Elisha ben Avuyah, and the famous Rabbi Akiva, or Akiva, you'll see his name spelled. So Ben Azai looked at God and died. Ben Zoma looked and went crazy. Acher, you know, went bonkers and started to destroy the garden. But Rabbi Akiva entered God's presence, the garden, the paradise, in peace and departed in peace. He survived. He did okay. So again, the story really sort of elevates Akiva's status as someone who could sort of handle this. And you say, well, you know, what's the big deal with that? Well, if we get a little further into the story, what I'm going to do now is I'm going to list out a few of the specific elements in the greater details of the story. And I think you'll be able to see how they actually run parallel to some of the things Paul says in 2 Corinthians 12. It's very interesting. So in the Pardes story, there are warnings given to the four against self-exaltation. Okay, and this is very common in Hekhalot literature. You know, you're going to see some stuff, but don't think it's because you're great. You know, don't get puffed up. Don't get a big ego. Don't, you know, go away here thinking that you're special or something like that. Even Akiva in the actual Pardes story, when he's asked, well, why didn't you go crazy and die and start, you know, destroying everything? Akiva says, it's not because I was greater than my fellows. So there's this emphasis on humility and against self-exaltation. Well, that's pretty clear what we have going on in 2 Corinthians 12. You know, Paul in 2 Corinthians 12 is engaged in defending his apostolic authority, his status as an apostle, which his opponents have, you know, of course, challenged. And we've talked about this on a number of episodes in the podcast. In those two chapters, 2 Corinthians 11 and 12, Paul has been challenged and, you know, he wants to defend himself. And so he sort of drifts into this, well, okay, let me talk about this guy I know that was caught up to paradise and saw visions and heard revelations from God. I'll talk about this guy because I don't really want to boast because boasting it's not good. It's not relevant. I don't want to do that because I want to focus on my weaknesses because that's where the Lord is magnified. You get this same kind of thing, again, going on in what Paul is doing. He wants to refrain from boasting, even as he drifts into this account of seeing the very presence of God, and in fact, seeing the Lord. I mean, he is seeing the anthropomorphized God. He's seeing God in the flesh, Jesus, the resurrected Christ. So, again, we get a very similar feel at that point to what Paul is saying. It's a divine counsel encounter. It's a divine encounter, what he's relating. Second point, the part A story of the four men, again, of course, Akiba is the only one that comes out of this sane and peacefully, also relates to the fact that if you survive this encounter, you will have supernatural powers and authority and, you know, supernatural abilities. You'll have a supernatural endorsement, essentially, that will be conferred upon you. Anyone who can survive, who basically gets to see the Merkavah, the throne of God, and survives, will be the one who is empowered to function as God's spokesperson, okay, God's emissary, God's ambassador. Well, look at Paul. Paul is using this experience to say, hey, I'm an apostle. And back in, you know, earlier chapters in 2 Corinthians, of course, in lots of other epistles, and in Luke, you know, Luke's writing of the book of Acts, Paul's authority, his status, is validated by supernatural powers, by the Spirit enabling him to do certain things like heal people. He raised, of course, Eutychus from the dead. You know, we saw that in an early episode. He exorcises demonic spirits. Again, it's the same sort of thing going on. He is God's spokesperson. What he is able to do validates him. And the only reason he can do it is because he's had a direct encounter with God, just like the prophets of old. Again, the whole divine counsel motif, you know, for validating who is a true spokesperson for God and who is not. Third one, the Jewish, again, pardes tradition. In that tradition, pardes was viewed, again, as the Edenic garden, the very, you know, dwelling place of God, the abode of God. It was essentially the celestial holy of holies. It's where God's presence was. And pardes becomes a term that is used for the uppermost level of heaven. And we get this language in the New Testament, and even in this passage here as well, about a tiered cosmology. Sometimes it's, you know, third heaven, and that's the language we get in 2 Corinthians 12. And you'll see that repeated in Jewish texts contemporary with Paul, and of course earlier than Paul, like in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Your cosmology will have three levels. The third heaven is the uppermost one. Sometimes there will also be seven levels of heaven, again, the uppermost one as well. And scholars have debated whether that's sort of like a doubling down on the cosmology, you know, that and some of these episodes where people will go through various stages of heaven before they see God. The first three kind of are repeated by the second three, and then you hit number seven, who is God. So there's actually a conceptual overlap. I don't want to get into the details of the seventh level and the third level. There's six of one and a half dozen of another. It's the same place. It's where God is. I will give, you know, some files to Trey that gives you the basics of that cosmology, because I know people are interested in that. I've gotten questions about that before, but I don't want to get too far into the issue now. So you can go read those things that Trey will post along with this episode. But the third point here, again, is this idea of the uppermost heaven is very common in these paradise stories. So back in 2 Corinthians 12, Paul alludes to the third heaven. And in verse 3, he uses the term paradise. In a very, very clear terminology there. And, you know, scholars have built good arguments that third heaven and paradise are, Paul's really talking about the same thing. But again, I don't want to belabor that. I think you get the point. Fourth point, Akiba and, of course, his three companions, again, one of them who dies, the other two sort of go bonkers. When they enter paradise, they hear conversations. They hear things that they are, you know, normally not privy and probably, you know, quote unquote, shouldn't be hearing. This is a conversation between God and those who attend him. It's a divine council meeting. They actually get to hear some of this, overhear it. And the paradise stories talk about people hearing these things and sort of either getting a sense of, well, I better not spill the beans when I get back to earth, or do I really belong here? I really shouldn't be listening to this. You know, I'm sort of out of place. I'm crashing the party. That sort of sense. So there's this feeling, impression that you get from these texts that the humans who get to see this you know, are not only privileged, but it also, there's a sense of inappropriateness or even peril in some cases where, you know, I really shouldn't be here. This is sort of above my pay grade kind of thing. Well, you get the same kind of feeling again with Paul in 2 Corinthians 12:4. He says that, you know, this man, you know, of course, who is him, you know, heard unutterable words, which it is not permitted for a man to speak. You know, so Paul, again, drifts into this episode in his life that he knows because he knows his Old Testament. And frankly, he knows his divine counsel theology too. He knows that this validates his status as a spokesperson for God, but he doesn't want to boast about it. And so he only obliquely alludes to, yeah, you know, I saw this and I heard some stuff, but I'm just not going to get into it again. And he couches it in this third person language, this man who was caught up into heaven. So he's trying to validate his status as an apostle, but yet not boast, yet not really get into it. You know, he doesn't want to use it, but he sort of feels he has to use it in some way, again, to address the attacks levied at him from his opponents that the Corinthians have heard. The Corinthians have heard Paul heard these other people trying to take Paul down. And so he's got to say something, but he doesn't really want to, you know, get into it too much. I think as well that this, again, the paradise stories, these divine encounters, these, you get to see the divine counsel thing. I also think that's what's behind Paul's line in 1 Corinthians 13 about, though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, that whole thing, you know, basically, if I don't have love, who cares about this? I think there's an oblique reference there to, again, this whole idea of the tongues of angels, that he's heard angelic conversations. And he's basically saying, look, even though I can tell you that I've been in the room, I have been in the room with God and heard these conversations, if I don't have love, that just doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean squat. So I think Paul's actually alluding to this episode, or maybe another one, in 1 Corinthians 13. Again, it's the same audience as the Corinthians. It's just kind of an interesting thing I thought I'd throw in there. But fifth, and finally, we'll do one more. The nature of Paul's thorn in the flesh, I think, is affected by these parallels too. Now, let's just say something about the thorn in the flesh a little bit. There are, of course, a number of different interpretations of this. In Greek, it's, you know, this, the thorn in the flesh is referred to as the messenger of Satan. It's angelos satana. You know, angelos normally gets translated angel, but of course that just means messenger, so messenger of Satan. So some have speculated that, well, maybe Paul was encountered by an entity, you know, that he's plagued by a divine being who is, you know, working for Satan or in cahoots or aligned with Satan's purposes, whatever, hostile to Paul and hostile to the program of God. That's one option. Others have said, you know, this is probably an illness. You know, some have said, well, it's an illness caused by, you know, a demonic entity or something like that. Again, scholars, you can read what the difference, you know, the different options are there. You know, I think, though, that any interpretation of this has to account for the connection, because Paul mentions this specifically right on the heels of relating this visionary experience. There's a connection in Paul's mind between this visionary experience and this, quote, thorn in the flesh, this messenger of Satan. And I think that is important because, again, here we go back to the Pardes stories. In the Pardes legend that includes Akiba actually encounters what he refers to as angels of destruction who seek to do him harm. They want to do violence to Akiba, and God forbids that in the part A story about Akiba. He protects Akiba from angels of destruction who show up in that event, again, to harm this person who God allowed to see the Merkava and not only survive but go away in peace. So that person, that human being, becomes a target of these angels of destruction, and God steps in and says, no, I'm not going to allow this. So again, scholars have looked at that and thought, boy, you know, that is a good argument that the thorn in the flesh, the messenger of Satan, is some sort of entity that is dogging Paul. And of course, Paul beseeches God and says, you know, can you do something about this? Can you remove this thing? Can you remove it? And God says, no, because, you know, I'm going to allow this to happen because my strength is made perfect in your weakness. So it ends differently for Paul, but yet there's this conceptual parallel. So I would say, again, to sort of move toward the end of our episode here, that I think the cumulative weight of evidence is is pretty clear. I don't know if I'd use the word compelling, but I think it's close to being compelling. I mean, you have five specific points of overlap with these earlier Merkava, you know, Hekhalot paradise stories. Again, these elements are in them. And again, even the one that sort of is most famous, and you say, well, the Akiba story, wasn't that after the New Testament era? Wasn't that after Paul lived? It was. Akiba lived after that. But scholars have noted that and saying, well, look, all these kinds of elements are in earlier literature, you know, going back to the Dead Sea Scrolls. So the Akiba story, again, adopts these elements and, of course, elevates Akiba as the leading rabbi of his day. And here we have in 2 Corinthians 12, look at what's going on with Paul. Paul's testimony aligns with these things. And so if you were a Jewish audience, like I said before, look, when your leaders tell you this stuff, they relate these experiences, you believe them and you give them authority. You listen to them. They become your spiritual leaders. And Paul knows this. I mean, he knows this, that the Jews have done this, that others have claimed, you know, to have seen the Lord and so on and so forth. And so when he's relating his testimony, it's very easy for us to say, you know what? Paul has a good argument here. And Paul is pressing them to hear him out because they can look at the Old Testament and say, oh, we believe the prophets. Oh, we believe God's messengers. Oh, we believe this rabbi. Oh, we believe this guy and this guy and this other guy. And Paul says, what about me? My story is no different. You need to give me an audience and you need to listen to what I have to say. Now, of course, there's one fundamental difference between Paul's story and everybody else. And I think you know what that is. In Paul's version, even though he's framing his call to ministry in a way that it's entirely consistent with the Old Testament prophets and every other spokesperson for God, all the way back to Adam through Noah, you know, just Moses, Joshua, even before we hit the classical prophets, all the major spokespeople for God had divine encounters. Even though Paul is couching his testimony to the Jews listening to him in language that they would have understood and known as consistent with biblical theology, his experience is different because who does he see? He sees Jesus. He sees this person whom they have crucified sitting on the throne. He sees the incarnate God, Jesus Christ. And that's the one back, going back to Acts 22 and verse 21. He said to me, Paul says, he, again, the Lord, from verse 19, he calls him the Lord. The Lord said to me, go, for I will send you far away to the Gentiles. And that they just don't want to hear. They don't want to hear this business about Jesus being on the throne. They don't want to hear this business about the Gentiles are part of the people of God. They just flip out. They flip out at that point. And the rest of Acts 22 is, you know, the tribune takes him back to the barracks. They're going to beat him. They're going to flog him. And of course, Paul interrupts and says, hey, is it lawful for you to do this to someone who's a Roman citizen? And of course, then the tribune flips out and says, well, now, wait a minute. You know, I got this by a considerable sum. You know, how did you become a Roman citizen? Paul says, hey, I was born one. And they stop. Again, they realize he's a Roman citizen and they could be in trouble by harming him without a trial. And this is the thing that triggers the events that follow. Paul's going to speak before the council, the Jewish council, the 70, the Sanhedrin. Again, it's not a coincidence that it's 70. This is the Jewish council, the religious council that is mirrored off divine council motifs from the Old Testament. These are the Jewish authorities. He's going to get to speak to them. And that's the whole episode we'll talk about, you know, next time about both, you know, Pharisees and Sadducees, you know, and Paul splits the crowd with what he says. We'll get to that in a future episode of the podcast. But this is the event that triggers Paul's time before that council. It triggers the event of Paul eventually appealing to Caesar, getting to Rome. And as we talked about on the podcast, on the previous episode, he's like, yeah, I can't wait to see you Roman guys, you know, you Roman gals, you know, that believe in Jesus. I can't wait to see you. But guess what? I'm just passing through because I'm supposed to go to Spain because I am the apostle to the Gentiles. And this needs to happen for the fullness of the Gentiles to be brought in so the Lord can return. Again, we talked about that before, but right here in Acts 22, this is what starts the whole ball rolling, this confrontation. And it's kind of interesting that it's prefaced by Paul's allusion back, or at least our, you know, we can link the two because we have the whole New Testament. Paul mentions this trance he had, and we know what went on with that trance because we can read 2 Corinthians 12. And so this whole thing is prefaced by Paul recounting his calling in the throne room of God, you know, right there with the throne room of God, with the divine council. And he says, they're the ones that sent me to the Gentiles. Again, for those of us who have the whole New Testament and can put these pieces together, it's really telling, because the rest of Paul's story, he's going to get to Rome. And of course, we know he wants to get to Spain, and we know why. So it helps us frame, again, what's going on in the book of Acts and in Paul's life.
All right, Mike, well, we appreciate you covering Acts 22. Next week, we're going to be covering Acts 23 and 24, maybe more.
Maybe, haven't decided yet, but at least those two chapters.
Okay, well, good deal. Is there anything else you'd like to mention for the show?
No, nothing else that's new to announce. Unfortunately, just pretty much status quo.
Okay, well, that's good enough for me. I just want to thank everybody for listening to another episode of the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.